Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for coming here tonight. We're here to talk about some issues that are both interesting and very important. I'd like to thank for ongoing financial and non-financial support from the Philosophy Department and the Graduate Student Association. In addition, I'd like to thank for promoting this and other events, several Giving What We Can volunteers, Alexis, Nick, another Nick, Tim, Jimmy, Yadzenia, and I'd like to thank the professors who shared this event with their students. Tonight's talk is organized by Giving What We Can. This is an organization, an international society of people who have pledged to give at least 10% of their pre-tax income to the world's most cost-effective charities to alleviate extreme global poverty and suffering. Here, at Giving What We Can Rutgers, a local chapter of their organization, we try to let others know about the numerous problems around the world, but more importantly, about the ways in which each person can make a substantial impact on the lives of the very worst off. Last month, Giving What We Can turned 3 years old. There are currently 264 official members, and as of today, they pledged over $100 million to the world's best charities. Tonight marks the second year anniversary of Giving What We Can Rutgers. We're now one of 10 chapters across the world, and we have over a dozen Rutgers students and alumni who have joined Giving What We Can. To learn more about Giving What We Can, you can visit givingwhatwecan.org/Rutgers, and you can come to our end of the year party that's going to be held exactly 1 week from today, on Tuesday, December 11th, at the Philosophy Department at 8 p.m. You can also find us on Facebook for more details. You may initially think that giving away 10% of one's income is an overly generous commitment, but I'd like to remind you that there has been an ancient tradition of tithing, a standard of giving away 10% of your income, and it was done by people far poorer than we are. You may think giving 10% is the most that you would be able to give, but I want to encourage you to keep an open mind about what path your life will take. Tonight, you will have a chance to listen to a very special individual, Zell Kravinsky. Zell received a national media attention when he gave away virtually all the money that he earned through his work in real estate. He gave away over $45 million to various charities, most to public health organizations. He made the largest individual contribution ever to the foundation supporting the Center of Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. Zell holds 2 PhD degrees from University of Pennsylvania in rhetoric, 89, and English literature, 94. We're very excited to welcome tonight's speaker, Zell Kravinsky.
What I'm going to talk about, and I'll talk for a while and then take questions, is pretty much my own long, strange trip, how I arrived at some of the same positions that Boris and members of his group hold. A social philosophy sometimes called utilitarianism, how I arrived at it, lacking the intellectual equipment of the people who work in the field of philosophy, but by more or less what I would call the operation of common sense or characterological inclination. And what I then did with the notions that had built up in me as far as what the good life would consist of, and what the reaction was from the world, in my family, outside my family, in the country, in the media, and what I learned from that reaction, which to me was like getting a PhD in American social thought. I felt I had learned so much about this country and about myself and my feelings and the inclinations of Americans that have put us in the situation we're in now, where we have accumulated such a vast quantity of the world's wealth. All that became a lot more comprehensible to me based on the positive and negative reactions to the small things that I had done that people found controversial. So I'll talk about that for a while, but I want to say at the outset, I talk about philanthropy, and sometimes people say something kind about me if they're philanthropically inclined, like Boris did, but I'm not presenting myself as any kind of exemplar of the philanthropic life or the ethical existence. I don't pretend to a sort of reverse pride and imagine, like a televangelist might, that he's the greatest sinner on the planet. I don't think of myself as ethically the most challenged human being, but I don't think of myself as ethically extraordinary. I think I'm pretty much in the middle, and just for that reason, because rightly or wrongly, I have always been convinced that I'm in the middle. I was amazed at the tremendously provoked reactions I seem to get from people by the things that I did. So first I'm going to tell you what I did and how I came to do it. Some of you are familiar with the philosophy known as utilitarianism, once summed up by its original proponents as advocating the greatest good for the greatest number. And of course, there's voluminous literature turned out by philosophy departments about it, with which I'm not familiar. But oddly enough, I seem to have arrived at precisely the same positions that utilitarians hold by what I consider common sense and what I call a characterological inclination. And it's this characterological inclination that makes me charitable. What that element of my character is a distaste for waste. I don't like waste. I can't stand, especially money, when money is wasted, and everything is translatable into money. Money is the fungible medium of our existence these days. So when I say waste of money, I mean waste of anything. And for that reason, I always lived very, very simply, very cheaply, always lived for less than $10,000 a year, even when I started to make a lot more than $10,000 a year. And some of the articles about me talk about how when I started getting into real estate, and my great friend and real estate partner is here tonight, and he knows that eating in the middle of my lecture, because I dragged him here tonight and he hasn't had dinner, and just out of pure friendship and good nature, he's come along, so he can eat. Well, the body has its needs, but I started buying real estate, and I would always live in the smallest apartment myself and fix up the others, and I wouldn't fix up the one I lived in. I'd take the one that didn't even have a bathroom or didn't have a kitchen, because I think it was just a waste of money to spend it on myself when I could invest that money in fixing up the other units and generate a greater income stream that way. So that was just, it wasn't philanthropy, it was an aversion to waste. But this aversion to waste eventually led me toward a position that someone else might achieve by sheer virtue, by a concern for others, or the love that Rabbi Jesus speaks of. That's the way I think of him, as a reformed rabbi who was teaching the teachings of Hillel, love thy neighbor as thyself. People have arrived at that by what you could call the great route. And I got there by what you could call the niggling or parsimonious route. I just didn't like waste. And eventually it seemed to me that anything that was spent on me procured an infinitesimal benefit relative to the benefit it could procure for someone who was in a much needier situation. So that anything I spent on myself was wasteful relative to contributing that to that person or some organization that benefited that person. It wasn't that my heart had grown to the point where I loved my fellow man and I wanted to give everything away to make everybody happy and make myself miserable. It was, as I say, an inclination of character. Maybe it came from my father having survived the Great Famine, 100,000 Russians a month were starving to death, and having survived three wars and terrible poverty and the death of his father when he was young. And my father passed on me the fear that the Great Depression would return, and he was always concerned that there was an immense amount of waste in the world, and that waste had a, I guess you could call it a negative moral valence to it. So purely out of a desire not to waste, I began to consider giving my money away. But the more I thought about it, the more it took on what I guess you'd have to call an ethical or even a spiritual dimension. Sometimes Boris and I have spoken about the leading proponent of utilitarianism in the world today is probably Peter Singer. Peter is a dear friend of mine. He became my friend when they were doing a profile of me in New Yorker magazine, and they couldn't find a public intellectual to say something good about what I had done, which was to give away almost all my money and then to give my kidney to some dying stranger who whom I never met, and to talk about making further donations. So I met Peter that way, and eventually, I guess, I began to arrive at what Peter would consider to be a suspect element of my makeup, what some people relate to as spiritual. When I talked to Peter's classes, I mentioned that another motive for my giving was a consideration of eternity. And Peter's an atheist. He doesn't like the mention of eternity. But I don't think of eternity as endless time. I don't think of eternity as some stasis or ecstasis beyond time. I think of eternity as a dimension that transpires alongside of time, in which all our deeds resonate with a quality or a specific quotient of what the King James Bible calls love and kindness, or the Hellenized Greeks around Jesus called charitas, or the Hebrews called chesed, sometimes translated as mercy or charity or loving kindness. So I do think that there is a judgment. I don't think there's a guy in the sky whose department it is to perform that calculus. But I think that there is a reckoning of the value of our existence that we all have to be mindful of. And sometimes I call it the Mack truck factor, where I think a Mack truck could hit me tomorrow if the calculus is done at that moment in time. Will I have justified the space I've taken up in time? Will I have justified the resources expended on me on this planet? So those considerations eventually led me to begin to give my money away. And the dangerous thing about beginning on that what some people call the ethical existence, so I didn't claim that I had achieved any kind of virtuous life. But the danger in that life, and many people bring that danger up to me, and they tell me that they're frightened of it, is that it could become habit forming. A lot of people say to me, well, if you start from that rationale, that, for instance, need should draw the lines of distribution. Anything that somebody needs more than I do, they should have. Whether it happens to be by the accidents of birth or chronology in my possession or in their possession, they should have it. Well, if you start down that road, where do you end? If you're giving away your coat, can you still hold on to your sweater? When do you give them what my old man used to call the shirt off your back? Some people bring up this consideration, and I always take them as sincere when they bring it up. Many people bring up this supposed catastrophe curve in giving the idea that there is there's a point at which the algorithm that yields the generosity endlessly generates further acts of generosity and immensely, infinitely impoverishes you, and then you become an object of charity. Sometimes when people bring this up, they're just rationalizing and they don't want to give away anything. Other times people actually have that fear. And probably what distinguishes me from people who haven't done the bizarre things that I've done is that my neurochemistry is such and my brain is wired such that I see that not as a fear but a thrill. I am fascinated by the prospect that I could, simply by an act of will, tomorrow morning I could wake up and I could begin an existence in which I would be unable to prevent myself from behaving ethically, which would be acting always and entirely in a self-sacrificial manner. To me, that's an enticing prospect, and that's probably what makes me perverse in the eyes of many people. It doesn't make me better or worse, but it when I began to talk about these things, it generated a great deal of controversy. When I think that I could begin that life, a life in which bathed in what I would call a light of reason, in that utilitarian calculus would be all my actions, everything I did could be weighed, I would know what I had to do with my life, I would know what I was doing that day, and I would never go to bed thinking I've wasted opportunities to contribute to the betterment of others or to more efficiently distribute the world's resources. To me, that is so fascinating that when people bring up this consideration, I say, yes, it is a danger. It's not necessarily something to be feared. It may be something to be desired and sought. But that sort of ecstasy, what you could call the ethical ecstasy, literally an ecstasis or a standing outside of yourself to consider the good of others, borders so closely on a religious mania that many people find it suspect. And when I was doing interviews and talking about it, there were a couple of representations of the life I described and my living it that found their way into the popular media. And that's what I want to talk about in the next part, and then I'll take questions. As Boris said, I gave away what was considered a lot of money considering the way I was living. I was living in a twin house. It cost $133,000, which happened to be actually the median price for a home sold in the Philadelphia area the year that I bought it. And we gave away a lot of money. And there was we were in People magazine. There was a flurry of interest in that. People wrote me asking for contributions, and people interviewed and whatnot. But I had read an article in the Wall Street Journal that described organ donation, and it said that for the first time, living donation, the donation of living organs, had come to equal the donation of cadaveric organs, organs from corpses. And poor reader that I am, despite having a couple of PhDs from Penn and having taught literature, I was such a poor reader that maybe I was reading. This is what Harold Bloom calls creative misprision. When you read what you want to read, I guess, and you haven't really read what's written, but I thought I was reading that the number of people giving their organs to strangers now equaled the number of donations from cadavers. And I thought, this is the most marvelous thing. Who wouldn't want to do this? I thought, this will be the most wonderful thing I've done, and after I've given my money away, this will be the treat that I'll reserve for myself. I'll give away my kidney, I'll save a life, and why shouldn't I do it? When the odds that you die, the morbidity rate, are approximately 1 in 4,000 when you give your kidney away. This is interesting information. They're simply the same morbidity rate that attaches to any procedure where you go under general anesthesia. By the way, if any of you have thought of organ donation, when you give your kidney away, there's exhaustive research in the last 60 years of organ donation that shows that actually your health improves. Even your kidney health doesn't, you have a better probability of high kidney health than you did before, because your one remaining kidney grows in strength and becomes a sort of super kidney. Your longevity increases. A lot of people don't know that. And they think that the reason may be that people feel better about themselves when they make a donation of their kidney to a relative, or the few people who've made altruistic donations, and that good feeling about your life persists, even studies have shown 20 years later. Anyway, I thought this would be a wonderful thing, and I had no idea that actually only 130 people in the U.S. had given their kidneys to strangers. I thought I was doing what everybody was doing, that it wasn't anything so great. And I did it, and then there was a flurry of media attention, and people thought, why does this guy have to give away all his money, and then he gives his kidney to a stranger, and he must be some kind of nut, and da-da-da-da-da. And in one interview I said that if there were someone who, if this man or woman were in a position to solve, they were on the verge of solving one of the great diseases, finding a cure for cancer or AIDS, and they could save hundreds of millions of lives, and they couldn't obtain a kidney by another way, I'd give them my second kidney. And then all hell broke loose. And all the networks kept calling, and they began plans to make a movie in my life, and I became a controversial topic, and people condemned me, and AOL ran a poll on their homepage where they asked 400,000 people voted, is he crazy or is he generous? And I was shocked by the reaction. I was actually shocked. I couldn't believe that people had actually read what I had said. And I would say, people would call me up on the phone for interviews, and I'd say, did you read what I said? Yeah. You're going to give your kidney away. And somebody asked me on TV, somebody named Paul Azan, who has a TV show for Fox, Mr. Kravinsky, how can you say you'll give away your second kidney? Are you crazy? Is this a death wish? And I would say to them, do you understand what I said? And they'd say, yeah, yeah, you said you'd give it for somebody who was cure cancer, cure AIDS. Finally, what I discovered was in a simple exercise where I'd say, just write down the number one on a piece of paper. And now to the right of that, write down the number 100 million. And I was, when I brought that up, I was thinking of Jonas Salk, for instance, who for a few years was on the verge of curing polio. They didn't know that Sabin was so close, but if Salk had died, people thought that there would be millions of lives thrown out the window. So they'd say, write one and write 100 million. Now look at the one. Yeah. Now look at the 100 million. Yeah. Now look at the one. Now look at the 100 million. At some point, they'd say, oh, wait a minute. I get it. Yeah. Maybe. Oh, yeah. And I'd say to them, what about the instances in our society where a sacrifice of a life, one life for one life, is valorized? And those instances are, for instance, a policeman and a fireman. And as I said to Boris driving up here, the fireman, we think he's done a good job, even if he stupidly sacrificed his life. Even if he went in there, and really there was no reason to suspect that the old lady was still in the place, but he thought maybe she was. So he went in there, and he died for nothing. And the truth is that the policemen and firemen, about 500 of them who died at the World Trade Center, there have been critiques that really those deaths were unnecessary, and there was no prospect of saving them. But we still valorize what we did, what they did. Or somebody serving in the military who jumps on a hand grenade and saves his platoon. We think that's great. So why was there this tremendous negative reaction when I said I would give my life to save 100 million lives? And even when I explained one against 100 million, there were people who would call into talk show and say, I don't care, the guy's a nut. I don't care if it's 100 million. You don't give your life. You don't give your second kidney away. I don't care if it's everybody on this planet. What I discovered, and this is a shocking fact about all of us, what I discovered is that each of us is operating with a certain ratio. I call it our life-to-life operating ratio, where we value our life at so many other lives, or fractions thereof. Now, in our society, that ratio is infinitesimal with reference to your children. In other words, every parent would give his or her life for their kid. But more than that, I have four kids, and I would give my life just to improve the level of happiness in one of my kids' lives. Other things being equal, if I wasn't hurting the other kids by sacrificing my life. It's just something you do as a parent. It's natural. So you're valuing your life there infinitesimally relative to your kid's life. So that's a value of less than one. But now that ratio radically and thunderously inverts once you leave the family circle. Now your life suddenly is worth thousands of other lives, and you don't think it's worth giving your life to save 100 people or 1,000 or 10,000 or 100 million unless you're in one of these rare instances where we allow for a one-to-one equation. To me, that doesn't make any sense. In our society, we subscribe to an ethos of egalitarianism. But what it basically means is that our votes are equal, but we can go in the voting booth and we can vote for whomever we like and we'll still get somebody in the White House. I used to say that there were two species of utilitarianism that obtained in American social life. And one was in the political process where our votes were equal. And the other was on a bus. For instance, on a bus, if you have a seat and somebody comes in and they're carrying more than you've got, you usually give up your seat for them. In fact, if that person is blind, you'll almost always give up your seat. If that person is elderly, you'll give up your seat. So it's very interesting that in that circumstance, just on that bus, everybody becomes a utilitarian. It's socially prescribed. But outside of that, not so much. And the great example of this that your group, Boris, is addressing is in the economic sphere where, and I believe that 100 years from now, people will find this incomprehensible, but we feel that it is every person's right to accumulate an infinite amount of the goods of life and have no care to their distribution, and that any interference with that right is prohibited by the Constitution, because we think that that's what Mr. Jefferson meant by life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So that was what happened to me, and that was what I learned from the reaction that I got. Everybody in America, I would say, operates with this calculus in mind, but all of us, to the extent that the ethical life in us has been awakened to any degree, all of us feel that this calculus is nonsensical or objectionable on any number of grounds. And for that very reason, when we feel it's being challenged, we are provoked. Boris was telling me that he had described, I think you said what drew the reaction was people who've dedicated 20% of their income giving away, and some people wrote angry things on the website about that. They were very provoked. And I was saying, when you get that angry reaction, you know that you've hit a note of resistance. You know that there's something that it's almost like what the Freudian analyst would call you've hit a repression when the resistance is that strong. And you know that's something you have to explore, and that the energy of repression simply becomes extroverted and projected out onto you as their anger at your proposition, when you'd think there'd be nothing that would generate anger about the suggestion that some of us should donate a little more than we do, or the simple fact of announcing that you've given out a little more. This is why what you do is always going to be challenging others. And when you embark upon a life in which the need of others will be considered as equal to your own need, which is the logical consequence, I think, of any egalitarianism, eventually it boils down to an equality of needs, and then the lines of distribution drawn by need exclusively and entirely. When you embark upon that, you're going to find resistance from your family, from your lovers, your partners and friends and companions and the people you meet. And you should understand that resistance is really a conversion to offense of a defensive posture that they've been maintaining against what they fear is the collapse of their social project, which is the accumulation of goods unto themselves, if they allow even momentarily the consideration that the guiding hand that ought to distribute these goods isn't theirs. Okay, so I think at this point I should take some questions and maybe develop a little more in the light of your questions.
Hi. Regarding your inclination against waste, I think that's very common, but the most common outlet for that is usually, doting on friends and especially family. You touched a bit near the end on what Peter Singer's response would be to that, so I'm just wondering, why didn't you decide, okay, my children need an Ivy League education, they would need sports cards and that sort of thing?
I'm not sure what your question is.
So most people, they have this inclination against waste, but, they're doting on families and friends. They're not, doting thousands and millions to charity. So why do you go in that direction?
Well, that's a good question. If you're going to be a thoroughgoing utilitarian, if you're going to think, I want my money to do the most good, then it's hard to believe that you can't find parts of the world where the need is greater than in your own neighborhood or your own family or among your friends. Since you mentioned Peter, Peter's frequently asked that question, and his argument is, people say, why should I give to the third world? Because it all goes to warlords and corrupt bureaucrats on every level. And his argument is that if 90 cents gets wasted that way, the dime that gets through does a lot more good than the dollar would among your friends. Some people say, you always hear, and if I had a dollar for every time I've heard this argument against what I've done, I'd have a lot more money to give away. People say charity begins at home. That's a great proverb. You put it up samplers. People who say charity begins at home, usually their charity ends at home. It's generally a rationalization. And it may have had more sense, in the past when the difficulties of distribution were such that dollar might have become a penny by the time it reached the third world. It might have made more sense also when people were poor, but it doesn't make any sense now. Now, if you ask me, am I living my life according to that precept? Of course I'm not. My four kids, probably three of them, I expect, will go to Ivy League or Ivy level institutions, or extremely expensive institutions. And before I gave the money away, I put over $1 million into a state 529 plan so that there'd be that money for them to go to college. But my daughter, bless her heart, has become aware lately that maybe she should go to a less expensive school than an Ivy. Although she's already applied early decision, and if she gets in, she's going to go. But it really doesn't make sense, the amount of money that we spend on an American education, when you think what that money could do overseas. But then you could say the same thing about, for instance, American healthcare. Why should we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to ameliorate the condition of our elderly when a fraction of that money could save thousands of lives by eliminating waterborne diseases in African villages? None of it makes any sense.
Do you have any techniques that you found to be effective when people respond to such hostility? What's your go-to strategy when people get angry?
Well, you know, a lot of people are going to work on you. If you decide to live any ethical life, people are going to work on you. The people you work with are going to say it's inconvenient for them. You're going to lose sexual partners over it. You're going to lose life partners over it. And you have to accept that when you embark on that life, you've become an educator, necessarily, because you're going to provoke that response. And it doesn't mean that you're trying to force it on other people, but people will act as if you are because they feel challenged. Why do they feel challenged? Because there's that, what's been called the still small voice within the conscience in them that I think is prompting them to consider the life that you've embarked on, and they want to quiet that. So the first thing I do is I try to let people know that I'm not suggesting that I'm better than they are, because I know damn well that I'm not. And a lot of people think if you're in the news for giving away money or for giving your organ away, you must think that you're better than everybody else. And they already start in with a fight with you that you're not. I went on talk shows where people called in and were already wanting to fight, tell me that I wasn't so great. And I hadn't even said I was, but I tell people very right out. As I say, it would be a perverse sort of self-glorification if I said, I'm a worse sinner than you are. I'm a terribly selfish person. I don't think I am terribly selfish, but I'm not terribly generous. When you tell people that, some people are reassured by that. And then I think the other thing that you can do is to find the hypocrisy, what you could call a blessed hypocrisy in everyone. A lot of the people who attack you, and this is why I say it's blessed. I don't mean to invoke religious terminology gratuitously, but some people who criticize you for being ludicrously generous or actually ludicrously generous themselves in certain ways, just not precisely the same ways that you are. They might be skinflints who don't give a lot to charity, but they might, for instance, my wife and I had a great conflict over the things that I was doing that would end up being played out in the media, and she ended up, they were making a movie of my life, and she sued them to stop the production of it, and she gave interviews. And people who supported her said, oh, it's terrible. He shouldn't do it because his wife is against it. You know, but my wife actually, she's a physician, a psychiatrist. She doesn't make any money in her practice. She's fortunate that her husband's in real estate, and I pay the bills. She breaks even, which is difficult because I'm always at risk of being audited by the IRS because they have sorts that find out doctors who say they don't make money, or people in professions where everybody makes money claiming they don't make money. But she just doesn't, because she doesn't charge very much. She charges so little, it's ridiculous. And sometimes she doesn't even cash the checks, and I find these uncashed checks on the floor of the car. So she's absurdly generous in that direction. So when you find out the fortunate hypocrisy, it's a bit of a paradox, but it's a wonderful hypocrisy. You bring that up to them and say, you know, you're more generous than I am, so don't give me that crap about how generous I am. Everybody has, or let's say that the vast majority of human beings, given the wonderful overlap there is in our genetic structure and in our inclinations of character, that the vast majority of human beings were all in certain circumstances generous and all in certain circumstances extraordinarily selfish. So there's an overlap between you and everybody else, and that's the second thing you can do. The third thing you can do is a quantitative reasoning, which works well with people who think that way, where, like I said, you say to them, do you believe that everyone is equal? Oh, yeah, everybody's equal. We're all equal. You believe that. And then you say, well, you think our vote should be equal? Yeah, of course our vote should be equal. Well, do you think that when we vote for the things that we need, when we vote with our bellies, when we vote for food, or when we vote for clothes, when we vote for shelter, should all those votes be equal? Well, yeah, maybe. You can bring people around to an egalitarian position, and you can show them that the inevitable consequence of their supposed egalitarianism, the inevitable consequence is an equation of needs. Now, some people have asked me, well, how can you say that everybody's lives are equal? For instance, your life, if you're giving away a lot, isn't your life more valuable than somebody in Africa who doesn't give away the money? You've saved a lot of lives and she hasn't. But the answer to that is always that every project I'm aware of historically that has disequated lives has been pernicious. People have established hierarchies of lives in the past, and we know some of those programs, and we know how they end up with the abolition of a people, as in genocide, or the abolition of a nation or a religion, or even the abolition of humanity. It's a terrible thing. We all go down that road once we begin to desecrate lives. So I say that we have to say that all lives are equal, and in that reasoning, I can't say that the fact that I'm giving away money or doing other good things in the world makes my life worth more than anybody else's. Okay, so those are the three steps, right? The first thing is you disavow pretension. You say you don't have any pretense of being better than them, and that's a relief. The second thing is you discover their blessed hypocrisy to them, that they're actually philanthropists, they just didn't know it, and they're stupidly generous in some respect. And the third is that you bring them around by, you could call it a quantitative or a logical calculation to your position. But they'll still leave you in the middle of the night, and that'll be the reason. Yeah. It's going to be a lonely life. Most people don't feel that way. If you really embark on the worthwhile, the good life, if the new life begins in you, you're going to be, loneliness comes with the territory.
So did you think when you gave away your fortune, you gave away your kidney, that was the most effective way to do good? Now, why not use the $45 million and sort of invest it and make even more money, save even more lives? Were you worried about corrupting influences?
Well, every time I talk every year to Princeton, and somebody always asks me that question, and there are a few ways to answer it. One is the bird in hand answer, that if you don't give away the money that you have, A, you could lose it. You might think people who have prospered in business always think that it's their brilliance. Usually it's random forces operating in the marketplace. You could lose it all. And the second is even worse, you could lose the impulse to give it away, which would be a personality decay. And either way, the money doesn't get distributed. So,
what about a donor advised fund or something like that?
Yeah, you can do that. I mean, some people have made that argument. What about the people who they didn't give away, and so they multiplied the money, they accumulated vast fortunes. Carnegie didn't give it away until late in his life. And in his Gospel of Wealth, he says, you're a real bastard if you die not having given it away. But it's okay if you accumulate it during your life. But actually, the warning light that should go off is this, that 9/10 of the people who bring up that consideration are rationalizing and have no intent of giving away all along the route.
But the donor advised fund, I think it would give you some protection against that.
Maybe it was the pleasure impulse, the pleasure-seeking impulse in me, that I wanted the pleasure of giving it away. And it also happens, and this is something I know a little bit about. I had to become knowledgeable about the legality and the taxation of charitable giving, and the way the U.S. tax structure is set up. It vastly advantages donations made during your life over donations made after you die. This is something you don't have to be concerned with if you're young, but when you're older, you should know that if you were to make donations now through vehicles like charitable remainder trusts or split interest donations, the advantages both to you and to your charitable recipient would be tremendously greater than if you wait to give the money at death. That's just a quirk of the tax code. It might not be that way in every country. But most, as I say, most of the people who say that, they have no intention of giving away. And then a lot of people who give away a lot toward the end actually had the habit of giving, and it was quickening in them. They were developing this ethical life all along the way. You know, the people like Gates and Buffett, who have signed a pledge. Buffett says he's giving away 99.9%. Gates is giving away the vast majority. Those people, they haven't been SOBs their whole lives. They've actually lived ethical lives. It's people don't undergo a vast conversion at the end of their lives.
You were talking about pleasure and like the pleasure of giving it away. Do you think that it was important that in your life you got media exposure? I think it was a good example as your wife, that no one knows that she's hiding these checks and things. Is it important for you to get that? It could be less wasteful for you to talk about it and get more people on it.
Well, you know, there were a lot of arguments. I don't deny that there was a selfish desire on my part to have a... Suddenly I had a platform, and everybody loves their 15 minutes of fame. So that was one factor that I'm not going to deny that it was... I'd been used to... you know, for years I was a lecturer, and now to have this audience, and it was a wonderful thing. There's also the fact that the charities... very much want to publicize your donations to encourage other people to give. And even if you tell them no, they get very crestfallen and it hurts their campaign and like that. And then, I resolved to use the platform that these interviews were giving me to push certain things. For instance, I did 3 CNN interviews and in all of them I talked about the fact that, among minorities in America, particularly minorities die off the kidney waiting list at 4 times the rate of the white population. And I made them run the statistics underneath me while I was a talking head. And a lot of people weren't aware of that fact. Now, one of the funny things that happened with me, and you know, once you're out there saying some unusual things, there are all kinds of repercussions in various versions of you that get transmitted. Like, there were 2 versions of my life that were presented on TV, and they were both pretty crazy. You know, this movie they were going to make of my life was crazy because they made me out to be a saint. I was just this person with a halo on my head, and I only thought about other people and how can I squeeze another buck out of, you know, it was kind of ludicrous, and I don't think anybody would have gone to see it, but anyway, they couldn't make it because my wife sued, but they did a version of my life on Law and Order, which was very, very funny. It was, I it really cracked me up. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but, oh, House, yeah, the second version was, House MD did a version of my life which was good, where there was this guy, and he gives away this money, and they quoted me, and they said things I had said. Like I said, if my mortality risk is 1 in 4,000 from giving my kidney. If I don't give my kidney and she dies, then I valued my life at 4,000 times hers, and that ratio is unacceptable. But the guy says this, he says all the things I said, and he finds a way to live a good existence, and his wife comes around, it's a wonderful story. That was the good version, and... Yeah. No, but he still gave away. Well, it was a little ambiguous as to whether they were raising the point whether he was giving away his impulse to give away so much was pathological or not because he had this disease. But mostly he was a sympathetic character, as opposed to Law and Order, where they showed a guy who looked like me and lived in my house and was saying all the things I'd said in interviews and made the money in real estate and gave it away and then gave his kidney to somebody. And that person had to be a utilitarian and promote his utilitarian ethos. And when that person decided not to be, he killed him to get the kidney back so he could give it to somebody else. It was crazy. It was just insane. But what this is, you know, America has this intense need for, there are so many media outlets that eventually everybody's life is going to be made into something ridiculous in various formats and media, and that's a fact of our life. Yes?
So it's like one thing to talk about. You're also talking about the life-to-life ratio and like how in order for this to work, you have to think of everybody as equal or else valuing other lives gets you into trouble. It's like, or valuing some lives more than others gets you into trouble and so on. So like...
Or be consistent. Give up your pretense of egalitarianism.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm not an egalitarian. I think I'm much better than you are. I'm worth 100 times what you are. I'll let your vote be equal to mine, but beyond that, forget it.
But, like, then what about, so, I guess the ideal
Well, I got in a lot of trouble because I said, I thought I was saying in an interview that my children's lives should be valued equal to other kids. And actually, the way the quote was printed, it sounded like I was saying my kids should be valued at less. But yeah, I do think that. So are you saying that that's a problematic position or? No, I think it, I don't think it's justifiable. Or let's put it this way, as a practical point, very few people will ever press you to equate the lives of your children and your loved ones and your own life with the life of, on a one-to-one basis. Nobody asks for that. All that the good life requires of you is that you lower the ratio maybe to 1 to 10. For instance, is it really worth me spending $1 million to put my kids through expensive colleges when they can get pretty much the same education somewhere else for $100,000 and that $900,000 could alter the terms of existence for 10,000 Africans? It's absurd. It's nonsensical. It doesn't mean I'm still not spending the money and living in a house that's way bigger than the six of us in my family and the eight cats require. But being aware of it maybe makes me a little more charitable. At the same time, I can't help, and my wife says this is a morbid disposition on my part, but I feel a certain guilt because I know that my life is absurdly wasteful. And not wasteful on a one-to-one basis, but wasteful on a 10-to-1 basis or a 100-to-1 basis. And it's a beautiful thing that my daughter, I have 3 sons and 1 daughter, and she's begun to feel that way. She's developed a planetary consciousness. And she says, Daddy, maybe we shouldn't live this way. It's absurd. Because apparently the planet is going to be doomed if enough people don't decide that this is a ludicrous way to live our lives.
Yes, sir.
You're granted a real estate investment. You're granted a good decision for your investment. I wonder, when you gave up your money, you just stated that about 90% of it will be filtered out before only 10% will make it to the cause that you have started. Well, it doesn't make a lot of rationale that it's not a well thought business decision that you gave it to an organization that you know that 90% will be filtered out. Couldn't you make a better decision that you could maximize the amount of output?
No, I don't believe that 90% of my donations will be wasted. That argument was an argument in extremis. It was saying even if 90% is wasted, if you give it, if you shoot it in the right direction, it's better that you send it distantly, far away from yourself, because that 10 cents will do more good in Africa than the dollar would in your neighborhood. It's not saying that necessarily all your donations will be wasted to that extent. I gave money mostly to public health, to a school of public health, to the Foundation for the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, and causes like that. You know, with the kidney donation, that's an interesting question. Actually, you have to ask why more people, why are so many people dying off the kidney waiting list? I've asked myself this many, many times. If all of us have the opportunity to save a life, or save many lives, we could give multiple organs, or you can give one organ that's chopped into two. You could save 2 lives. Why aren't we doing it? If the risk isn't our lives. And the question is, as opposed to money, that there are certain religious taboos with regard to the body, or at least an identification of self with body that strikes me as nonsensical because I've never subscribed to that identification. People feel that they would never give away a part of themselves and they define themselves as their body. But there was a point when I wanted to encourage people to give organ donations and I would say to somebody, well, if you give an organ donation, I'll pay the expenses. And then I had to ask myself, that could run into tens of thousands of dollars. Does that make sense when that same money could be in some other direction could save a whole bunch of lives. But I wasn't suggesting that that's the fate of every donation, to be frittered away to that extreme. Yeah, Alan.
Zell researches where he gives his donations very, very thoroughly. As much as he does his real estate, as much as he does his philosophy with it. He's, in that particular regard, it's not just like United Way. He'll look at a particular cause where he thinks, he mentioned one where the disease that was being researched would have a donation.
Chagas disease.
Yeah, would make a big effect and have a lot of potential with it, you know, with something that he could make a difference on it.
Yeah, that's an interesting instance. There was this, I learned about Chagas disease, which afflicts 1 million to 2 million people and kills 50,000 people a year. And there were guys at the CDC moonlighting on AIDS grants who had come up with a solution to it. And they felt that they could, that solution could be actionable, could be practical in the field with an amount of money simply in the millions. So however many millions it was, whether it was 10 million or 40 million, the fact that you save 50,000 lives every year consistently, and nobody's going to come up with another cure for God knows how many decades. So there are, when you talk about what used to be called bang for the buck, there are amazing things that small amount of money can do. And I should come around to that topic because in Boris's group, there are a lot of people who are young and starting out in their lives, and they read about people like Gates or Buffett giving away huge, immense amounts of money, and maybe they think, well, why should I give? It's a spit in the bucket. What can I do? If I can only give away, even if I pledge 20% a year and I'm only earning $40,000 and I give away $8,000. But the purpose of your organization, as I understand it, is to educate the public and to self-educate and until the pipe squeeze, maximize the effect of even small donations to the point where you could be doing wonderful things and saving thousands of lives simply from what you've saved on a teacher's salary. All kinds of people have done this. In fact, I think, I don't know, this is a romantic notion of mine, but I think that if you start out with the intent to live the ethical life and to do that, that almost miraculously you may be supplied the means to do your work at a level of magnitude you hadn't imagined.
Regarding the organ shortage, do you think as a utilitarian it makes sense to maybe deregulate the laws regarding selling organs?
Absolutely. I've been an advocate of a market for organs, and the arguments made against it never make any sense. They always pretend to be protecting the poor and minority communities, especially where they say predators will come in, offer them money. Actually, in countries where they allow organ sales, none of that takes place. But the first thing that they could do that would eliminate the, and this is a serious situation, there are about 100,000 people now on organ waiting lists, and by some people's count, 10,000 people die a year because people aren't donating their kidneys. One problem is that a lot of people think they've become cadaveric donations because on their driver's license, it indicates that and they don't know that what hospitals do is they disregard that and they don't take it anyway. If anybody in your entourage, it's supposed to be a near relative, but if your aunt's drunken boyfriend is along and at the hospital and says, well, I don't think we want to do, then they don't do that. And they don't do it because they could give they're afraid of being sued, and nobody has ever sued a hospital saying that some poor disadvantaged person died in the ghetto because you were not honoring the law, which requires you to harvest the organs of a kidney donor. Many states have passed laws. I've spoken to politicians about this. States and localities that say redundantly, because actually by contractual law they also have to honor what you have. But states have, just to pound it in their heads, they passed laws and said, hospitals, you have to start taking these organs, and they still don't. And that's why people die. So some of you who think that many people think that they've done something wonderful by, at the Department of Motor Vehicle, putting this down as an organ donor, and they don't know that nothing comes of that. But organ donation, just to put a plug in, organ donation is something that you should think about. If you give away And kidney donation is the easiest organ donation because it's been the one most frequently performed, the procedure, and we have the widest body of data, and we can say unequivocally that it is not deleterious to your health, and in fact gives you a wonderful feeling about yourself, and there's just nothing like it. There's absolutely, I mean, even there, I've met people who've given an organ to a family member, and they even have professions where they've saved lives, and they say it's still not the same thing. Nothing I've ever done has felt like as good as giving my kidney to my husband or my son or my father. That's something you could think about. It's something I think about all the time, that I would like to make another organ donation at some point in the future. But when I talked about that in the media, people told me I was crazy, and the surgeon said they would never perform it and I should be arrested and whatnot. And so I don't talk about it anymore. Also, it would anger my wife, and that would be the end of my marriage. So I have to decide if that's something I want to do now, or at the point where they don't want to harvest it anymore because I'm too old. But think of it: saving a life that doesn't cost your life. For me, it was. I say this, and people sometimes don't catch the pun, but for me, giving my organ was a no-brainer. I was stupid enough to think that everybody was doing it. I gave the organ. That was a very joyful thing, even though it was painful, and I don't like taking opiates, so it was painful. But it's the wonderful thing about it is that your recipient recovers quicker than you do. Your recipient is instantly better. In fact, even their complexion changes during the course of the procedure. When they get the kidney in, and suddenly their blood is being purified, they get up off the table and they feel like they can't remember feeling that good. Now, all they have to do is take a regime of specific immune suppressants, but other than that, they're fine, and they're now off the dialysis machines, and they're not in danger of losing their lives, and you see that right before your eyes, and it's just a wonderful thing. You know, nobody can take that away from you. Yes, sir.
Are you still working with real estate? If so, do you enjoy it more now?
I still work in real estate, and my wife and I, we still make donations. Although after, you know, there was all this publicity about how crummy we lived, I ended up buying her a nice big house that she wanted, and now she says she didn't want, or it's too expensive, or we shouldn't have bought it, and it's... There's a lot of upkeep to it, but I'm still in real estate, and I'm still trying to make money, and I still hope to do things philanthropically. I don't see any reason for anybody to be in business unless they're doing good, but there are people who are doing good just by the business that they're in, and there are other people who are doing bad by the business they're in, and they better give the money away and reverse some of that horrible karma. But like Alan, my partner there, the example I sometimes give is that he put up two buildings in a, I'd call it a working class income demo, and he did it without government subsidies. People aren't usually willing to do that. People, they put up low-income housing when there are all kinds of tax schemes that subsidize it, or they build for people who have money, and that's something good you can do in real estate.
Before you were born, it was just your dad raised you that way. What about people who, most of their life...
My father was also a communist, and he believed in that the Third World was oppressed and their lives were as valuable as ours.
My grandmother was a communist, too. But what about people whose grandmothers are not communists and are diehard capitalists and they're raised that way?
Well, then you might have to disappoint them by your lifestyle, you know. People... Everybody in your group is going to have to face this thing that if they really decide they're going to give 20% of their income or whatever, they're going to live this life of charity, you're going to get grief from all quarters. You know, the people you work with don't want you to become ethical all of a sudden because probably what you're doing is not entirely based on ethics.
Thank you.
Look at all these questionable professions we have. You know, it's something you have to do and take the consequences. I don't know. People are so afraid of the fear of nonconformity is so extreme that it causes people to commit what. Now, some people have said, are you saying it's murder if you don't save a life? Because I've said things that logically it is equivalent if you take a life versus if you don't save a life. But people get very offended at that. The fact that all day long by the choices that we make, we're killing people and we're saving lives and we're taking lives. But apparently the planet is doomed unless we begin to realize that everything we drive and we eat and all those choices that we make are having those consequences. Well, it's interesting that you bring up, you know, corporations feel under no constraint to be philosophically consistent, but they have adopted, at the same time as they've adopted the corporate ethos of philanthropy, they've adopted the ethos of shareholder benefit, that a corporation only exists to benefit its owners, the shareholders, not to benefit its stakeholders, like the employees or its vendors or the people who rely on the products it creates. So it's pretty crazy, and you're right, a lot of people get sucked into that trap. But one of the things that you learn when you embark on this life is that you don't have the answers at the outset, and that you're going to be required to consistently throughout your life recalibrate and sometimes junk your whole project and start a new one because you've miscalculated benefit. If you want to be a utilitarian, you have to be at least an amateur mathematician to some extent, and you have to always be making these calculations, like Walmart. Alan and I own a bunch of Walmarts. Yeah, not the businesses, just the stores. It's been a very profitable investment. And some people think Walmarts are bad. Other people think Walmarts are good. Walmarts raise the standard of living of the working class very considerably because they can buy a lot more. And the working class aren't the people who complain about Walmart. But the elite complain that they've heard that people are not sufficiently compensated to work for Walmart, and less efficient businesses go out and all of that. So I guess what people are being required to do, not only as consumers, but in all aspects of their lives now, is to be more philosophical, or I would say more logical or mathematical about the decisions they make, or realize that really during the course of the day you're making 1,000 decisions. Each one of them is consequential. And consequential in fantastically exaggerated and tragic or wonderful ways. You know, it adds a dimension to your life if you think that way, that everything that you do resonates very greatly, because it does. The way the world is knit together, that there's nothing that you do with your life now that won't have immense repercussions for good or ill. That wasn't the way it was in the shtetl when my father and his family grew up. I think that anything other than giving away the bulk of their money is nonsensical and ethically indefensible. When you're talking about people who are immensely wealthy and can satisfy their needs on a minuscule portion of their wealth, you know, nobody denies what economists call marginal return or the law of diminishing return, marginal utility, that the first 40,000 gives you a middle-class life. The next 40,000 gives you this, that, and the other thing, but 400,000 beyond that doesn't vastly add to your happiness. So I don't understand, and this is my own incomprehension, but I don't understand why people who have so much more than they need wouldn't give away the bulk of it. Some people feel that people who are, this is, you know, they're always aggressive wings of these movements, like Peter Singer, when some people considered him the father of the animal rights movement, and he disavows what some people have done, where they break into labs and they set free laboratory animals, and that kind of thing. But some people who are in this movement that everyone in Boris's group is part of, this burgeoning new philanthropy that is, I think, transforming the social landscape of America, some feel that you have to do what the gays did when they were becoming liberated and struggling for their civil rights, and they outed gays. We didn't want to admit that they were gays, and they'd say, you're queer. Admit that you're queer. We're queer. We're not going. And other people thought that was a terrible thing to do, but a lot of people feel that we should shame the persons of wealth who have given nothing to philanthropy. And Business Week once decided to publish a list of the people who had given the lowest amounts out of their vast fortunes to charity, and it did shame people. And Larry Ellison had to make a statement because he's given nothing away. He had to make some crackpot statement where he claimed that the minuscule amount he had given away was given away very efficiently, but actually he started to give a little more away. You know, that Zuckerberg with Facebook was kind of shamed into giving away $100 million that way. So maybe you need, what you think of the way the animal rights activists, they throw blood on people who are still wearing furs. Maybe you need to walk into the offices of corporate CEOs and investment bankers and shame them if they haven't given enough away. If you feel that the planet is dying because of the primitive accumulation of a savage portion of the human race, then maybe that action is called for. Does that sound crazy? I don't know. Okay, Boris has some remarks. Thank you very much.
I'd like to make a few quick announcements and concluding remarks before you leave here tonight. If you've enjoyed tonight's event, we hope to see you at our other events. There will be one last event this semester, the end of the year party on Tuesday, December 11th at 8 p.m. in the philosophy department. Over the past 2 years, over a dozen Rutgers students have joined Giving What We Can and thus pledged to give at least 10% of their pre-tax income to the cost-effective charities working on eliminating extreme world poverty and suffering. Perhaps you too will join Giving What We Can in the future. It is a big decision, and we don't expect you to take it today. You might be hesitant for many reasons, and would like to address some of them now. You may be overwhelmed when you learn about how much needless suffering there is in the world, and may thus underestimate the impact you can have. But just because you can't solve the whole problem doesn't mean you shouldn't help people individually. You might erroneously think that you need to get rich first to make a measurable positive difference in someone else's life, but the good news is that you don't. As a college graduate, your starting salary will be approximately $45,000. 10% of that is a sizable amount of money, and when given, for example, to one of the charities Giving What We Can recommends, you can cure about 1,300 people of parasitic worms for life. Even if you give only 1% of your income, you will still cure about 130 people of parasitic worms for their entire lives every single year that you choose to give. And this you'd be able to do for the rest of your life as long as you give to the most cost-effective charities. It used to be very hard to know which charities were the best. Now it has become easy. Giving What We Can has done research for over the past 3 years about the charities that are the most that give you the most good for the dollar, so the biggest bang for the buck. And for over 5 years now, GiveWell, an independent charity evaluator, has been working full-time to find the charities that will help as many people as possible with the money that you can give. Both organizations agree on several charitable organizations. Both charities share their results and their research publicly online. You can find out more information about Giving What We Can and its research at givingwhatwecan.org and about the research that GiveWell has been doing at givewell.org. Finally, I'd like to share a short autobiographical note with you in hopes of inspiring you to give to cost-effective charities. I guarantee you will be proud of your charitable giving when you're older and you look back on your actions. I learned about extreme world poverty and the current moral social issues, a philosophy class at Rutgers, taught by Larry Temkin. Then I realized and became excited that by simply giving away to the more cost-effective charities, I can do as much as 1,000 times more good than by giving to average charities. So what that meant is by giving a single dollar to the best charity, I could do as much good as giving $1,000 to an average charity. So last year, I chose to give 20% of my income away. And this year, inspired by people, in part by people like Zell Kravinsky, I've chosen to give away 50% of my income to charity. To this day, I'm amazed that with an average starting salary as a high school math teacher, and after giving away 50% of my income, I'm still in the richest 4% of the world's population. It is astounding to me that I live better than most kings. I eat fresher and more varied food. I listen to the world's best music at a press of a button. I have heating, cooling, and internal plumbing in my apartment. I read the best books in the world. And I don't need to worry about being assassinated. It brings me a great deal of satisfaction to know that a significant fraction of my time that I spend at work, I work not to better my life, but to tremendously help thousands of others. I hope you've been inspired to make giving at least a small part of your life. You don't have to be rich to start, but even if you think that you do, remember that you already are rich by any comparison to over a billion people living here on Earth. Start small. Start today. Even if you give $1, as long as you give it to the most cost-effective charity, you can make someone's life much better. It costs just 50 cents to get rid of parasitic worms in a person's stomach for a whole year. Your donation goes a long way when the charity you give to is cost-effective. You can buy one less coffee this week and give savings to charity. Depending on how fancy the coffee you avoid buying, you could cure as many as 7 people from parasitic worms for a whole year. Alternatively, you could still buy a coffee, you just buy it at a cheaper retailer, and cure 3 people for parasitic worms. You can go see a movie, but instead of watching it in the evening, watch it in the afternoon. You can save $2, donate it, and cure 4 people of parasitic worms. There are plenty of ways as a student you can still get the joys you like, but also immensely help dozens of other people. Thank you for coming.